From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, improving the tensions between Grand Rapids police and black residents, we talk with the police chief.
I want to get back to staffing levels that allow us to do more than just triage public service. What we're doing here, I think, is a bit of a disservice to the community that wants a relationship.
The DEQ scientists, first to sound the alarm about PFAS chemicals and contamination in our state.
I call them the contaminants from hell because they travel everywhere, they bioaccumulate, they're indestructible. We need them for so many things.
A warning, millions of elderly Americans are getting hooked on the drugs used for anxiety and sleep problems.
These medications should be used for a couple weeks or at most a couple months. However, many folks end up staying on these medications long term.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We begin today with the Grand Rapids Police Department. For more than a year now, a task force has reviewed the department's policies and operations that could lead to racial disparities in policing. The task force was formed after a study found black drivers were twice as likely to be stopped by Grand Rapids police. The relationship between the police and communities of color in Grand Rapids has been especially fraught in recent years. Several innocent and unarmed black children have been arrested, handcuffed, or had a gun drawn on them by police in the past 2 years. And that's led to community outrage and demands for serious reform. Last month, the task force released a list of 38 recommendations for the department aimed at reducing racial disparities and addressing these community concerns. Yesterday, Police Chief David Rohinski went before the City Commission to present his plan for implementing these changes. Grand Rapids Police Chief David Rohinski is with us now. Welcome, Chief.
Thanks for having me.
So this task force had a long, long list of changes that are going to take time to implement. I'm interested for you. What are the very first and most important steps?
So I should clarify, some of the steps, we haven't been waiting for the recommendations to come out in total to tackle the steps that needed to be addressed immediately. So one of the first steps we identified as being important was a youth policy that would give additional direction and discretion to officers regarding when to handcuff youthful or juvenile individuals that they would come in contact with. So as to your earlier statement, we had some high-profile incidents where juveniles were suspected of being in possession of a handgun. That led to handcuffing, which ultimately led to a lot of public discourse. So that one of the first things we did was created a youth interaction policy with input from community stakeholders and the police department.
So what's different with that youth interaction policy?
So a couple of things. I think first and foremost was the public education part. In the two incidents that were most high profile, ultimately firearms were not discovered on the individuals. That being said, we had a very robust conversation with community stakeholders that when someone calls 911 and says they see a young person with a gun, we have to respond as though a gun is in play. Secondly was additional training for officers in terms of empowering them to use their discretion. I think traditionally law enforcement has really been governed by policy and procedures and operating on a worst-case scenario mindset. We really encouraged our officers to treat young people like young people and to look at the totality of the circumstances when making judgments. So training is important, but so is common sense and discretion.
When it comes to recommendations, Chief, for staffing and for recruiting, what do you see as the plans for that area that would reduce these racial disparities in policing?
So one of the things that we heard repeatedly from community was that they didn't feel as though the Grand Rapids Police Department was fully invested in community policing. And we explained that about 8 years ago in 2010, this was a department that was staffed with over 400 sworn personnel. When the economy got tough here in Michigan, the department reduced in size by almost 25%. We went down to under 300 sworn. So on any given night, officers generally are responding from call to call to call. So the ability to walk the parks, be present in the schools, walk the business districts, and really get to know the people who were sworn in to serve and create relationships built on trust, that eroded. So if we're going to be a fixture in the community, and as opposed to just triaging and responding to emergency calls for service, we're going to have to get back to previous staffing levels. So on November 27th, we'll go in front of City Commission with a request to bring in a consultant to do a staffing and deployment study so we can really be robust enough to fulfill what we're hearing from the community, which is they want a relationship with the police department that consists of more than just us responding to calls for service.
I'm speaking with Grand Rapids Police Chief David Rohinsky about how the department will be implementing recommendations from a task force designed to reduce racial disparities. Chief, having the trust of the community, it is very important to a police department to do its job well. I don't need to tell you that. And in recent community forums, Black residents have talked about how hard it is to trust police given this fraud history. Let's listen to a few of these voices.
I don't see nothing coming of it. When I first moved here, they was doing these same type of forums, and it was for the adults. Now it's the kids.
It doesn't do anything to hold officers accountable to not targeting minorities. So that's really what the problem is. The policy is not written in a way that changes anything. And when the outcomes are still the same, then it's a problem and something needs to change from it.
If a criminal broke into my house tonight, I trust the criminal faster than I would the police.
That was Juanita Lagan, Tavian Moore, and Elaine Howell as they spoke at a recent community forum about this new youth interaction policy. That last comment, Chief, how did that make you feel that I would trust the criminal before I would trust the police?
So in that particular instance, we had an encounter with Mrs. Lagan and her daughter. We had been called to her residence based upon a neighbor hearing shots fired, and officers responded accordingly. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case. So I'm very sensitive to her emotional response. I can understand it, and I recognize the situation that she was placed in was very unfortunate. But I also recognize that we've got an obligation when someone calls 911 and says that shots were fired from in front of or from within the neighbor's home, we've got a duty to respond. And unfortunately, those outcomes aren't always what we would want as a department, what we would want as a community.
And so taking that more deeply, how do you rebuild trust with people who feel like things aren't going to change? We've seen talk before, but we haven't seen change. How do you rebuild that trust?
So I think first, we can point to some very tangible changes. We've been very successful as of late in hiring more diverse groups of officers. I think that's important that the police department mirror the makeup of the community in terms of building trust and rapport. We can point to training that we've undertaken. So the traffic stop was self-initiated. That was introspective. We wanted to make sure that our policing efforts weren't resulting in disparate outcomes. So that was something we undertook proactively. We then went through a CALEA assessment, which is a commission for accreditation of law enforcement agencies, something only 10% of the police departments around the country actually have done. So we invited outside assessors to come in and vet our department, look at all our policies, do public interviews, and look at the department, and we achieved that accreditation. More recently, we received recognition from the New York University School of Law. They came and recognized Grand Rapids as one of five cities across the nation that are doing unique things regarding community outreach. We also have undertaken training initiatives that have included community stakeholders. So I think we've made some very concrete, very tangible steps that we can all point to collectively as showing that we've got momentum, we've got energy, and we're moving the needle.
Chief, what about you? Has all of this changed the way you feel or you think about policing and about race and community policing?
So I try to be sensitive. I've been in the profession for over three decades, and I think I bring my lifetime of experience to that role. But I recognize it's a very big ask to put that same expectation when a 21, 22-year-old police officer who doesn't have the life experience, doesn't have maybe the historical background to recognize some of these issues in their proper context. So the same way that we ask officers to be empathetic with community and the role that we serve in terms of trying to fulfill their wants and needs, I also ask community to be empathetic with the young men and women who are wearing the uniform, oftentimes responding to calls with very little information, responding with the best of intentions, but sometimes the outcomes aren't what the officers would hope for. And unfortunately, that is at times the nature of law enforcement, but I'm proud of the work that our men and women do. I'm proud of the level of commitment. I'm proud of their character and professionalism. So I think at my age, it's a little easier for me to be introspective, but I try to be appreciative of the work that the young people who wear this uniform every day and go out to serve the community do.
Chief, how will you measure success of the new policies, this revised direction for the department?
So I think we're seeing it now. I think the fact that we have community meetings and they're attended by a good number of people, that tells me that they've got confidence in the process. If we held these community input sessions and no one came, that would send a message to me that they think there's a disconnect between what they intend to share with us and what we're going to put in action. But the fact that people continue to come out, continue to share their concerns with the expectation that they're going to see change, I think sends the right message. So this is a very engaged community. It's a police department that really has a unique bond with the community we serve. Some of the things we've done here in Grand Rapids, from teaching inner city baseball to being assigned full time at the Boys and Girls Clubs to having a presence at summer camps, are unique. And I think that relationship continues to get better.
So Chief, what are the immediate next steps? How are you prioritizing the actions that you want to take?
So I think most importantly, and it sounds self-serving, but the staffing and deployment study on November 27th. So we're an agency of 295 sworn. 8 years ago, we had over 400 officers. So consistently, I go to community meetings and I hear from community stakeholders, I used to know the officer who patrolled my neighborhood. I used to see you guys out on foot. I used to see you at the parks. I don't see that anymore. And that really is a result of the reduction in staffing. So first and foremost is on the 27th, we'll go in front of the City Commission. We'll get that staffing and deployment study funded, get it underway, and then I want to get back to staffing levels that allow us to do more than just triage public service. That doesn't give us a chance to build the trust that we need.
Grand Rapids Chief of Police David Rohinsky, we want to thank you for your time, and we certainly look forward to speaking with you again on Stateside.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up, millions of older Americans are getting hooked on anti-anxiety medications.
Patients often believe that prescriptions given by a physician must be safe.
But that's not always the case, and we'll hear why in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
If we have to go to the White House, I'm going as myself.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
What it means is open up your goddamn market the way we opened up ours.
Although the advent of the internet and all the subsequent trolling is still fairly recent for Michigan, public trolling, however, let's just say that goes back to long before Michigan became a state. Today's story has public trolling. It has letter writing and insults, even a challenge to a duel, very much the way fans of the musical Hamilton see things escalate between Hamilton and Burr until it comes down to Weehawken, Dawn. Guns drawn. Let's dive into this story now with State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Mark, set this dispute up for us because it certainly led to a healthy amount of what today we would call trolling. When did this happen and what ignited things?
Well, you have to imagine the streets of Detroit in 1807. The city had already been around for about 106 years, but it was still rough around the edges. The Michigan Territory was just created in 1805 under the rules of the Northwest Ordinance. But the biggest resource at this time wasn't gas or oil or water, it was land. And everyone wanted to be in on it. They wanted to be buying it, selling it, or in this case, surveying it.
At the same time that 1805, there was the Detroit Fire.
Yes, there was. So there's a lot going on here. And what happened in this particular instance is William Hull, the territorial governor, he had the ability to appoint people to commissions and also to be deputy surveyors. And he appointed his nephew, Abijah Hull, as a deputy surveyor. And surveying was a good gig. Unlike today, you didn't actually have to be good at surveying. It wasn't the most important requirement at this time. And so a lot of the early surveys were either fraudulent or inaccurate.
Okay, so surveying's a good gig, and you're powerful because, as you say, land is everything when we're talking about the early 1800s in the Detroit area.
Yeah, economy is not stable. Surveying was a stable job because there was this vast amount of land that had to be surveyed, good or bad, and also had a certain amount of status to go with it.
All right, so territorial governor William Hull appoints his nephew Abijah Hull as surveyor because, I guess, what, nepotism, and I'm going to take care of my nephew. And then what happened?
So we can say that, and it's probably true, but again, it wasn't that uncommon. But it really outraged two land commissioners, Stanley Griswold and James Abbott, and they were so angry over this that they fired off a letter to the Secretary of Treasury. At this point in our country's history, the Secretary of Treasury oversaw surveying. The U.S. didn't create the General Land Office until 1812, sent it off to the highest official they could find.
So they fire off their letter of complaints. What were they complaining about? What were they not happy about?
We don't have the actual complaint letter, but we can assume that the complaint centered around the fact that it was an unjust appointment, it was nepotism. Probably in there somewhere was the fact that they wanted to be the deputy surveyor or someone they know.
All right. And how did Abijah Hull respond to basically somebody blowing the whistle on him on a letter to Washington?
He freaked out, I think is the most succinct way to say it. And he did it in 1807 style, which means he publicly posted a letter stating that, quote, he told Stanley Griswold and James Abbott to their faces that their writing was a, quote, damned rascally piece of business and that they were, quote, damned rascals for doing it. And then he also said, and Stanley Griswold's a liar.
I love this. And I assume Griswold and Abbott responded back in kind.
Yeah, they did. Although they sort of took the high road. They just sent another letter back to, now with the local land register, Peter Audrain. They wrote another letter to the Secretary of Treasury instead of publicly responding. Basically saying, see, this guy's not fit for the position. This just proves all of our points. And in the meantime, while that's going on, Hull just keeps going and starts posting placards all over town, verbally assaulting Griswold and Abbott.
I think I saw something. He posted a counter letter calling Griswold and Abbott, and I quote here, liars, rascals, and scoundrels, and who are destitute of manly courage. You know, this back and forth letter writing does remind me very much of the A. Ham, A. Burr letters that led to Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton dueling at dawn at Weehawken in 1805. Spoiler alert, didn't turn out well for Hamilton. So where did this public trolling between Hull and Griswold and Abbott lead to?
So next, the law enforcement got involved. So Hull was arrested by Elijah Brush. There's a lot of familiar names, early Detroit familiar names
there
here.
Are.
He was the territorial attorney general. So he arrested Hull because this is essentially slander and it's illegal. And he set bail at $500, which...
Big bucks.
That's big bucks in 1807.
Yes.
So now Hull's in jail. And Hull wrote a letter stating that he doubted he would get a fair shake in the legal system and that he expected that Abbott and Griswold would, quote, give him satisfaction due a gentleman by meeting me at 11 o'clock tomorrow at the windmill on Petticoat on the other side of the Detroit River.
So the Canadian side.
Yeah,
okay.
The Canadian side, because it's not, as far as we know, not legal at this point to have a duel. So as you said, this is only a couple years, 2-3 years after Burr and Hamilton. The other thing that's interesting to note is, unlike Burr and Hamilton, if we read this correctly, Hull challenged two people to a duel, which,
yes.
If you're familiar with the, you know, the underpinnings of a duel, it's not great odds for Hull at this point.
Absolutely. So did the duel happen?
No, it didn't happen.
Yeah,
spoiler alert, it didn't happen.
How'd this resolve itself?
Well, not very Hollywood-esque. So Hull resigned and left the territory. Abbott was removed from his commissioner office by Governor Hull. Griswold was put on trial for some fictitious charges and wound up paying a $1,000 fine and then left his commissioner's post when his term ended 2 months later. So not super exciting ending, but very interesting story.
In the meantime, what about that survey of Detroit that was needed after the Great Fire?
The surveys in Michigan really didn't get established till around 1816. So there's right up to that point, there's still a lot of fits and starts and inaccurate surveys and more of this favoritism towards giving these people positions. And it wasn't until the General Land Office was established and this was really regimented that the surveys were done in a meaningful way. And if you see early maps of Michigan, you'll understand
yes.
what I mean.
And does the Michigan History Center have souvenirs of all of this public trolling in the archive?
Yeah, so many of these actual letters that we've been talking about percolated up through the territorial records and wound up in the conservation office's land office division. Those are actually available for the public to research and read, and I'm sure we'll put an example up online for everyone to see as well.
Well, you have to put the one where the with an apostrophe D, rascally, capitalized rascally, not just generic rascal.
Yeah, I kept looking in those letters for a phrase like, so untrue.
So sad.
Yeah, so sad.
The story of Michigan's first publicly recorded trolling incident leading to arrests, a challenge to a duel that never happened, and a supposed sham trial. State archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, very entertaining. Thank you so much. Damned rascally piece of business.
Thank you.
There has been much focus on America's drug addiction problem with prescription drugs, most of it centering on younger people abusing opioid painkillers such as Vicodin. But a University of Michigan study warns millions of elderly Americans are getting hooked on the anti-anxiety meds that are used for sleep problems, depression, and anxiety. We're talking about the class of drugs called benzodiazepines, drugs with brand names we know well, Xanax, Klonopin, Valium. Dr. Lauren Gerlach is the lead geriatric psychiatrist at U of M. She conducted the study and with us now. So we're putting the spotlight more on younger people getting dependent on prescription drugs, but your study warns we should be looking also at grandma and grandpa?
That's correct. Our study is really trying to highlight a growing recognition of some of the concerns and safety worries about use of these medications among older adults. While these medications first were kind of released and started to be used in the United States in the 1960s and have been used for many decades, there's now a growing recognition about some of these safety risks. For older adults in particular, there are specific risks such as falls and concerns regarding car accidents and worsening cognitive impairment or memory concerns.
So what kind of triggered your radar to point you toward doing this study?
So as a geriatric psychiatrist, I work clinically with many older adults who have anxiety and have sleep issues. And so certainly many folks come to us kind of seeking help with these problems. And many folks will ask for a medication to help relieve the symptoms or wonder what other treatment alternatives might be out there. Based on our clinical work, as well as the work of other folks that have shown that there's been growing use of these medications among older adults, it really made us interested to try to figure out what were the factors that led to people using these medications for longer than they should.
And when you say longer than they should, what are we talking about? What is a longer than they should look like?
For most folks, the use of these medications in older adults should really be short term. So these medications should be used for a couple weeks or at most a couple months. However, many folks end up staying on these medications long term. So for anywhere from 6 months to a year or even many years of use of the medication.
So you've got now a population that has had access. When you're talking about people in their 60s and their 70s, these older Americans, they've had access to these drugs. So you've got this population you can study. So tell us what you found as far as the kinds of results that happen from taking it too long.
What we found in this study was that 1 in 4 older adults who were newly started on one of these medications, benzodiazepines, as you said, mm-hmm. these are sedative medications commonly known as Xanax, Klonopin, Valium, that 1 in 4 patients stayed on these medications long-term over the next year. We found that non-clinical factors such as patient race and the number of pills provided in that initial prescription were some of the strongest predictors of who stayed onto the medication long term. We also looked at a variety of different clinical measures. We looked at anxiety rating scales, we looked at depression, we looked at sleep measures, we looked at measures of pain. And out of all of those clinical measures, the only thing that we found predicted who stayed on the medication long term were those patients who had very poor sleep or had insomnia.
And that is the kind of a thing that will take somebody to their doctor going, I cannot sleep. And I think, am I right? Because in my experience and people I know, there's kind of a sense that maybe taking a Xanax doesn't have the feeling of dependency the way some of these sleep medications that are heavily advertised that people take, Ambien, we'll say, for example, that you worry about whether you're going to be dependent on that. I don't know that people are aware that they should worry about the benzodiazepines like Xanax.
Exactly. And I think that, as I had said, that these medications have been used for many decades and were really thought to be safe medications. So in the 1960s, they were marketed as mother's little helper. And so they were often prescribed by physicians, and patients often believe that prescriptions given by a physician must be safe. However, we found that the longer that people take these medications, the harder it can be for them to get off of the medications, as well as the increased time they're at risk of developing some of the side effects to these medications.
And let's talk about that. What are the ways that these benzodiazepines affect our physical and our psychological state?
Some of the things that have been shown across many different studies are that these medications can increase the risk of falls. And so for older adults who might have osteoporosis or kind of weakening of the bones, that puts them at a greater risk for fracture. And so whereas a 20-year-old who falls may not have an injury, an 80-year-old who falls may end up breaking their hip, and that may be the factor that precipitates them going to a nursing home or losing independence.
But what's happening in the brain that makes them at greater risk for falls?
So what can happen is these medications can cause some confusion and they can cloud our memory. And so we might not be as alert or aware of the things that are happening. There's been some larger epidemiologic studies that have looked at hundreds of thousands of patients and found that these medications may also be associated with a greater risk of dementia and cognitive impairment over the long term.
What is the takeaway, first of all, for prescribing physicians?
One of the things that really struck me in this study was that we found that a larger supply of medications in that initial prescription was one of the strongest factors that then predicted who went on to long-term use. So in fact, for every 10 additional days prescribed, that nearly doubled a patient's risk of going on to long-term use. So for me, that really highlights that we want prescribers to really start with the end in mind, meaning that when they provide that initial prescription, I want them to be aware of how the prescription that they're providing may lead to long-term use in patients. So thinking about things about prescribing less day supply in that initial prescription, as well as thinking about what effective non-pharmacologic or non-drug treatment options are out there.
And for patients. And children of patients.
Exactly.
Adult children.
Yep. And so, you know, a couple things that I'd want patients and children or caregivers to think about. One is that these medications, as they're prescribed over the long term, patients may develop a dependence on the medication. And I just want to say that sometimes addiction and dependence get a little bit conflated. And so for these medications, people may become physically dependent on them, meaning that if they stop the medication, they may not feel well. So over the time that we take these medications, people can develop both a physical and a psychological dependence to the medication. So if patients are going to stop these medications, it's important that they talk with their primary care physician or their psychiatrist to talk about how to come off these medications safely. For some patients, long-term use of these medications may be warranted and may be appropriate. However, for other folks, these medications may have been continued for years, and it's not really clear that they're providing much benefit.
And I'm going to have you just kind of take us down that path that you touched on, that we tend to conflate addiction with dependence. Break that down for us.
The way that this class of medication works is that as you take it over time, your body will become physically dependent on the medications. So if you stop the medication, you may notice worsening sleep. You may notice a worsening of anxiety. You may have tremor. You may not feel well. And so these are medications that your body becomes dependent on. Addiction, on the other hand, will sometimes think about certain behaviors, such as kind of using more than prescribed amounts of medication, seeking medication from multiple prescribers. And I think that these are different topics.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, what's the next question that you want to explore?
I think there's a couple things to think about. One is that, you know, it's very good to describe the problem, but we want to do something about it as well, too. So it's very important for us to think about the next steps for these patients to think about how to safely get them off of the medication. There's a couple studies that will be done at the University of Michigan and other places that are trying to work within primary care clinics to think about how to best educate primary care physicians and patients about the risks of these problems. The other thing that we're looking to do is that this study was just looking at a relatively smaller number of older adults, 600 patients, and so we will be replicating a similar study looking at a much larger population of, say, 100,000 patients to see if we see similar things in a larger population study.
Back to the physician behavior, why is it that sometimes people are a little loose and free with giving prescriptions and not monitoring how much a patient's using?
Often these prescriptions will start as a well-intentioned means to try to ease depression, anxiety, or sleep for older adults. In kind of the context of a routine primary care appointment, physicians are very busy. And so it can be very hard to kind of initiate and have these tough conversations with patients about use of these medications. A lot of times patients and providers won't know that these medications can be dangerous over the long term. And also providers and patients may not be aware that there are many effective non-medication alternatives available that are equally effective, if not more effective, in treating sleep and anxiety. These can be things like different forms of therapy, like cognitive behavioral therapy. And there's also many tapering strategies to help patients safely get off these medications comfortably.
Dr. Lauren Gerlach, lead geriatric psychiatrist at the University of Michigan, and the study that she led finding 1 in 4 older adults who are prescribed drugs such as Valium, such as Xanax, go on to risky long-term use. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, we talk to the Department of Environmental Quality scientist who raised concerns about PFAS chemicals years ago.
I quickly discovered these things were found around the globe and that they were indestructible. You couldn't get rid of them once you got them out in the environment.
That is up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How well has the state of Michigan responded to the problem of PFAS contamination of our groundwater? That was the focus of a Grand Rapids hearing Tuesday convened by U.S. Senator Gary Peters, who made a point to single out a veteran geologist at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality.
When I first began to hear from constituents concerned about PFAS contamination, one name came up over and over again, and that was Bob Delaney. Bob's decade-long work on PFAS, his tireless persistence in advancing our understanding of the threat, and his foresight and bravery in sounding the alarm make him a legendary figure among the community of Michiganders working to protect our water.
And Bob Delaney is with us now. Bob, welcome to Stateside.
Good to be here, Cindy.
Bob, when did you first discover there was a problem with PFAS chemicals in the Michigan environment? What put this on your radar?
I discovered it in 2010. I work on Defense Department cleanups of bases, and I am involved with the various national committees and stuff. And so during one of those committee team meetings and trainings, they discussed emerging contaminants, chemicals that were going to be coming up as a potential problem. And really the Defense Department had the foresight to be looking at what chemicals they were using and what ones might become a problem environmentally, because they didn't want to keep using chemicals and then have to clean them up later. So they came in, talked to several of us from the states and told us about different chemicals. And one of them that came up was a triple F, the firefighting foam that's used on all the bases, and the chemicals specifically were PFOS and PFOA. So it was in March of 2010 that I really got my introduction to the chemicals, and then we found them at the base.
So you found them at the base, and then how did it progress from there?
So when we learned about these chemicals and my consultant, we'd been negotiating with the Air Force for maybe 20 years on this cleanup of this one fire training area, and we'd finally come to an agreement on what was going to be done. Well, while my consultant was out there, he saw this black soil that had never been sampled before, and so I had just had this training. I told him, well, sample it for everything, and why don't you add these PFOS and PFOA chemicals and see if they're there? And he did, and it came back that they were highly contaminated. From that point forward, we knew that there was a potential problem because of the training on the whole base, and we started taking duplicate samples of everything the Air Force did. And as we proceeded, we found PFOS, PFOA, and a bunch of other chemicals all over the base, all through the surface water and in all the fish.
And what did you think as you began to peel away
the kind of the layers and discovered the scope of the problem with PFAS and PFOA chemicals?
Well, first of all, just understanding, one of my specialties has been contaminant fate and transport. How do contaminants get into the environment? How do they move through the environment? And where do they end up, like in people or fish or, you know, in the eagle or something like that? So that's something I had always been aware of. But what was different about this whole situation was I quickly discovered these things were found around the globe and that they were indestructible. You couldn't get rid of them once you got them out in the environment. And then what we typically did is I was a geologist. I didn't know how toxic things were. So I went and I talked to our toxicologist I asked him how toxic are these and what kind of criteria would I have to have the Air Force clean things up. So what he did is he came back with really preliminary numbers of 60 and 100 parts per trillion for these chemicals in groundwater. So what that meant was for people drinking the water, he was saying that, you know, it looks like from the scientific literature that that's kind of the criteria that will end up, the Air Force will have to clean things up to. And I realized right then that this would mean I'd have to tell the Air Force to start totally over with characterizing the site. We'd have to have all new remedies up there because the remedies we'd already agreed to wouldn't work. And so the thing that was different was I said, well, if I got to go argue with the Air Force about these things and try and get them to take on something that was totally brand new and to say that, you know, all the millions you spent aren't sufficient, then I wanted to be really sure that I agreed with my toxicologist that these things were real. So I dove into trying to understand how toxic they were, what was happening when people had ingested them, what studies were out there. Those were two areas of study I had never taken on before. That was toxicology and epidemiology. It got me to the point where, like I said in my testimony yesterday, I was literally afraid. I was frightened for my children, for the future. And I also felt that the weight of the world was on my shoulders, because if I didn't know about this stuff, the massive number of people and elected officials and media didn't know anything about it either.
At yesterday's hearing, you said, and I'm quoting you, you felt like you were at the edge of an abyss looking into hell. Those are some very, very powerful feelings.
Yeah. I mean, I have not felt those strong of feelings, certainly never with work. I have certain, you know, personal issues with children and stuff like that. You might have strong feelings, but you know, as a scientist, I kind of look at everything kind of abstractly and sort of impersonal. But this became very, very personal to me, which was different than anything else I'd ever done. So, yeah, and I call them the contaminants from hell because they, you know, they travel everywhere, they bioaccumulate, they're indestructible. We need them for so many things, you know. It's the perfect contaminant if you want to create a problem.
In 2012, Bob Delaney, you sent a 93-page report to DEQ Director Dan Wyand. So this is a couple years down the road after you've done all this digging. You spelled out your concerns about the threat that PFAS posed to Michigan residents. You recommended actions the DEQ could take to address these threats, to alert the public. What were some of those recommendations?
Oh, it was a myriad of recommendations. One of the things I wanted to do was look at the blood and try and isolate the problems in Michigan where people were getting greater exposures. The Red Cross gets blood from people all across the state. Well, I wanted us to look at those blood samples. I wanted to check the food that we were consuming, because as I pointed out, when we quit making these chemicals, or at least the long chain ones, a certain family of them, the Chinese took it up. And so what were they doing to their environment? What were they doing? So is our food supply okay? And my biggest emphasis was saying, look, we can't clean all this stuff up immediately. What we want to really make sure is we're just not consuming it. We're not taking it in. The director was brought in. My understanding was that he came over from Agricultural Department, and MDEQ at that time was having a hard time getting funding and working with the elected officials and things like that. And he had a terrific reputation to be able to work with the various players out there. And so he would readily admit, you know, the environmental's not my big, you know, something I really know a lot about. But I do know, understand government. I do understand, you know, funding and those kinds of things. And so it wasn't that they were trying to downplay the environment. It was just that we were having such a funding problem that he was brought in to try and solve that problem. So when talking to him and giving him advice or things like that, I was trying to really get him to, I was asking him to go to the governor and talk about these things, but I wanted to make sure he was convinced that it wasn't just Bob Delaney, geologist, tells director and director runs to the governor and explains this stuff. I wanted him to bring in scientists, other scientists to talk to him. I wanted him to form a work group within the department or talk with the other directors who also have a part in this to be really sure and confident before he would talk with the governor. Mm-hmm. And then I also, you know, he asked me at one point, well, what should I do? And I just said, really, it comes down to leadership and taking leadership of this issue. And so we had really good conversation, but you know, the rest is history.
Well, what happened after you submitted that report?
Well, I know from later, I heard that it got distributed to upper managers in DEQ. What happened other than that, I don't know what happened, if anything.
Now, MDEQ has repeatedly said it did not ignore your 2012 report. When did top-level DEQ administrators first really talk with you about it?
Well, actually, I mean, nobody's talked to me about it until this last year, since probably October of 2017. But they did. There were things that were done. I gave a presentation in 2010 to the deputy director Jim Saigo and our division chief Linnell Maroff. Unfortunately, both of those people have passed away, but they were old timers like myself, been around from the beginning. And Jim established our small work group on PFAS, and that's what led to the 2011 white paper that was part of my testimony. And they also added to our normal yearly sampling for fish and water. They added PFAS chemicals to that. But then after that, things didn't seem to really progress much across the state.
Well, as each new governor takes office, and as you called, you said an old timer, you've had a lot of decades of service at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. So each governor comes into office, they bring with them new leaders, a new approach to how they implement each department's mission. So in that some 30 years, you've seen a number of these transitions. How would you describe how the culture and priorities at MDEQ changed, if at all, when Rick Snyder became governor?
Well, let me give you a context. I came into the department as a geologist in 1979. And at that time, Michigan was an environmental, the government was a leader in the world in environmental protection. We were pioneering a lot of stuff that eventually the nation would adapt. And we were identifying our sites, and we were very, very aggressive. Economic hard times came on the state, and that deteriorated till now. I would have to say we don't live up to that kind of level of commitment and investment and talent. And that's sort of a sign of the times. Each governor has brought in a different administration, and Governor Snyder came in with sort of a mandate to fix the economy. And he was brought in from, you know, we voted in somebody that was from the business community. And the perception has always been in the business community that they're overregulated, that, you know, a lot of people feel that we're doing too much on the environment and various other things like that. And so every administration reflects what the culture is doing. And sort of that's sort of what was reflected in the early days of the administration. Since the Flint thing has occurred, you know, we've taken more of an aggressive, more informed approach to things.
I'm speaking with Bob Delaney, a veteran geologist with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. He was one of the very first, if not the first, DEQ staffer to sound a warning about PFAS contamination in Michigan. It was a year ago this month when the state created MPART, the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team, and the state touts its efforts as being among the most robust responses to this challenge in the nation. What are your thoughts about the DEQ's current approach to our PFAS and PFOA problem?
Well, like I've said, nothing is perfect. But here's the thing that I knew when the governor decided to do this, that this would change the discussion across the nation when he decided in his administration that we were going to sample the water systems all across the state. Because once that data started to come in, that data is informing the whole nation of the problem. And Michigan is by far not the only state with PFAS problems. We're just the ones that are, us and a few other states are really shining a light on, hey, this is in your water, this is in your food, this is in your drink, your surface water, you're in your fish, you need to do something about it. We're finding this to be the truth. And so just kudos to the governor for taking that kind of aggressive action and getting the data out and stuff like that. But also what's happening is we're trying to grapple with a problem that I've said a long time, it's too big. It's too big. Nobody wants to take it on because it's too big of a problem. And that's why, you know, if you watch the testimony yesterday, I got off talking about health problems that these chemicals and others are causing in our culture. You know, if we're going to decide to tackle this, then we have to have a really compelling reason. And to me, that's the compelling reason. Are there really health effects that are impacting our society and our children that we need to address, and are chemicals the problem?
And the science seems to be still rather unclear about just how harmful these chemicals are to human health. What are your feelings and thoughts as you dive into the research and the science of this?
Well, there's multiple things I think about that. One of the things that people really should understand, and I included it in my testimony in the 2012 report, I included a letter from the Weinberg Group. And it's a letter to DuPont telling DuPont that what they would do to neutralize the government, what they would do to change people's minds and things like that. And I think that's a huge story. From what I understand, they worked for the cigarette industry. So you kind of understand where they're at. And they've never disavowed that letter that they sent to DuPont. And I think something that the media has to understand is science is really complicated and difficult, and it takes people with real conviction and real honesty to get to the bottom of things. And so it's not hard to confuse everybody. You can put out some reports, and I'm not saying the Weinberg Group did that, but in this case, you can see what they said in their letter they would do. And you can confuse the public, you can confuse the elected officials, you can confuse everybody pretty simply.
I'm wondering, Bob, how has all of this affected you, your life, your career over these past 8 years since you first kind of hit on the scope of this problem?
It's made my life complicated, I can say that. I don't know, you know, one of the most satisfying things in life is to be able to work at something you care about. And so in that sense, I've never cared more about my job than I do now. On the flip side, it is, you know, it's an emotional roller coaster. If it weren't for good friends and my church and my faith, that'd be a real, real struggle.
Bob Delaney, longtime scientist with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, the first at the DEQ to raise concerns about PFAS contamination in Michigan. Bob, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us and spending time with us on Stateside.
Well, thank you, Cindy. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to interview me.
We reached out to a representative for former MDEQ Director Dan Wyant to give him the chance to respond. We have not yet heard back. We'll be right back. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.